Welcome, everybody, to another special edition of the Hello Show. This is episode 12 you're listening to, and I'm Dave Lawrence.
I'm David Kendall.
And we have a very special guest with us this time who has braved the internets to join us, Mr. Thomas Brand.
Well, I don't know if I'm extra special, but thanks for having me on, guys.
Curator of the delightful Egg Freckles web publication.
If it ever got off the ground, yeah, sure, you could give me that credit. It's a good name, though. I didn't invent that, but it's a good name.
It is.
I stole that well.
It's the perfect domain name. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Now we just need some perfect content to match up with it. But eggfreckles.net, it will come there. Something will happen.
Right.
You'll decide on a CMS one day.
Exactly. You know, something besides switching CMSs every 2 weeks or so.
Right.
I was like that thing.
Thomas is the author of, like you said, eggfreckles.net, which is one of my favorite looking blogs. It is just so fun. And I remember back in the early days when I was just starting Newton Poetry that I was out there looking for other Newton blogs. And his just blew me away. If you go there, you can see it looks just like a message pad 2100, except now it's a little bit more squat, Tom.
Well, yes, I guess the original idea was to gain some kind of fame or a recognition for having a blog that looked exactly like a Apple Newton message pad. And that went through a couple of different iterations. You know, it was black and white, it had color, it had a backlight, it could go sideways, all these different ideas. Very little content, but lots of different design ideas. And I guess the current idea is to actually emphasize on the content, and part of that means letting the design expand for content over the height of a Newton message pad. So right now it's squat due to lack of content, but the idea is the same.
When it does have content, I really enjoy it, though.
I'm trying to post more regularly starting last week. That was the plan. So we'll see how this comes along. Maybe by the time this podcast is published, it will have a more normal Newton aspect ratio. But until then, it's a little squat.
Yeah. It's like the Newton Nano or something.
Exactly. It's brief.
One of my favorite parts about
it is... It also started out the actual size of a Newton in terms of pixels, and now it's doubled in width. So it's a lot easier for it to be squat now because I've got more width to grow on before my height equals out. Something like that.
Mm. Right. Yeah, one of my favorite parts about it is that at night, you turn on the backlight.
Yeah, it's on this little time-based JavaScript. I need to improve it, but supposedly, you know, half of the day it's the backlight's on, and then half of the day it's not, depending on your browser's time settings. But I wrote it kind of feverishly, and it doesn't seem to always work how I think it should. So I think it's wrong, and you know, needs to be updated. But yeah, that's the general plan. The backlight comes on at night.
Right. That's still pretty cool.
Well, thank you.
And I noticed you've got images up there. You've got some graphics.
Well, right now each of the posts has some. I've put some work into getting some graphics in there just to make things more interesting. One of the problems that I found with having a blog that resembles a Newton is that the resembling a Newton doesn't carry it alone. You need to have decent content for people to actually read it and come back to it. And for a blog, that usually includes images.
Right.
Those images are actually usually composed of, once again, icons or something I've ripped off. But they go through a very special process, and that's this software called HyperDiver. I think it's made by a Tin Rocket. And what that software does is it uses the original algorithm that was used in Mac Paint dither the artwork
the
in that way. Yeah, it's a Tin Rocket LLC, and it's uses the original Atkinson dithering effect that was used in the original Thunder Scanner or whatnot. Bill Atkinson's, later in Mac Paint. So it makes that those wonderfully divvied images that you can't get by just using Photoshop alone.
And, well, they look great. They look really neat. You know, all black and white out.
Thank you, but once again, can't take much credit for it. You just put in the program and it goes to work there.
Right. Well, I haven't seen it before.
One of the things was between the backlight colors and the daylight colors was picking a color that would work for all the images. Because before I would have, you know, the color of the text would be different from the backlight versus the daylight themes. And I've settled on a color that kind of works good with both. And because of that, all the images are actually represented in that single color to give it that dither Newton appeal. So I guess that came some, you know, some compromises had to come to getting that shade of green or whatever you want to call it.
Right. Well, it looks authentic. That's the important part. Mm.
Well, hopefully it will, you know, keep growing in length, as you said, and hold the...
It will be an ultra-wide screen, Newton.
Well, that, or that too. Hopefully not too wide, but it'll grow out. I guess, for a long time I was troubled by what to write about, because I have all these wonderful ideas in my head, but I'm not really an expert on any particular area. So I kind of settled on to just write on things that I do with my computer. Which, you know, I guess I am an expert in because it's the things I do. And I think I have some unique solutions to share with the world in terms of how to set up your computer or sync things or, you know, how I organize files. I don't know, just the basics, but the ways I do them.
Yeah, the Dropbox stuff is particularly interesting because it's such a neat way of dealing with your files and syncing and stuff that I thought they were pretty helpful.
Oh, the Dropbox is my favorite application or service or whatever you want to call it. I really think that it completes the dream of having multiple computers in sync all the time. As an example of this, I have it installed on my home iMac, which I'm using right now to record this podcast, as well as my office desktop, which is a Mac Pro down the street at the hospital I work at. And so what I do is I have them both set up with one set of files that are in my Dropbox. That means that they're in sync through this Dropbox service. Whatever I put in the Dropbox folder gets uploaded to the Dropbox website and then downloaded to the other computer. So effectively, I can make a change, like saving this podcast, and then leave my computer at home and go to my computer at work and expect everything to be just as I left it, the file to be in the exact same state that I left it at home, perfectly in sync, provided the computers remain on, of course. And so that's what I do. I leave my computers on and I leave Dropbox running and everything is syncing 100% of the time. And it's fantastic.
It's kind of a dream come true.
Oh, it's great. They should pay me to be some kind of evangelist for the system. You know? it provides backup. It provides versions. You can share anything that's in your Dropbox with anyone else by just giving them a URL. And, you know, it's people are all concerned about remoting into their computers nowadays. And I just think that's such a last century solution. Why not just have all your files with you or on the cloud wherever you go? And that way you don't have to care about connecting into a particular computer. You've just got everything you need. I've given up on having a laptop and just carry an iPad now because I can run the Dropbox app and have all of my computer desktop files with me wherever I am.
No kidding.
So, yeah, if you haven't tried that, you know, use the link on the bottom of my site. It gets me more space and gets you a Dropbox account, and it's fantastic.
Huh. Yeah, it's been a few people that I've heard that have kind of given up on the laptop and gone full iPad for mobile stuff. So how easy is it to edit files and save them and things like that? I've heard that's pretty tough.
Well, I'm not there 100% just yet. I've been a mobile user for a very long time now. I've always wanted to use the you know, least possible hardware to get the job done, especially when I'm on the road. And that used to include things like an iBook or a 12-inch power book. And then a Newton for a very long time. You know, I don't take the Newton with me all the time just now, but that was how I used to write this blog, and it's still how I write down a lot of my notes, is just having something like that with me. But the iPad is kind of a unique solution because it provides a lot of the capabilities of a computer, but with the benefits that a Newton offered, in that it has a very long battery life, relatively speaking. You know, it has the functionality to keep you organized, your contacts, your addresses, map information, you know, text editing capabilities, things like that. So I find it appealing. The biggest problem, though, is that Apple really hasn't introduced, you know, it opened up the iPad to the cloud. And so you're forced to tether and sync to do a lot of things. And I just think that's so backwards, especially in the day and age that we can use Dropbox to sync everything.
Right.
It's made me actually migrate from an iPhone to an Android phone. One of the reasons being that Dropbox on the Android is much more powerful, in that you can download things from it and save things, and you have access to the file system. So in my mind, the Android is much more like the Newton is than an iPhone or iPad is, because the Newton has been opened up to, you know, from restrictions. So many people have continued to develop for it and add on to its capabilities. It's kind of a homegrown community, and the Android platform is a lot more like that. You're able to do more things because people have opened up the restrictions and allowed you to, you know, share and edit your documents among applications much more easily.
That's a really good point. I've never thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big Apple fanboy. I love the iPhone. I think it's fantastic. But the combination of being able to edit anything with you wherever you go, and you know, have it on whatever carrier you choose, that's a lot of choice there. And I'm a big fan of having that kind of choice where I want it, at least.
So which phone are you using?
Well, right now, I'm a big fan of Sprint. I actually manage the mobile phones for my department at the hospital, and we have Sprint antennas in the hospital, so I get great coverage at work. So I'm using a Sprint Evo here, which is limited to the United States because it's a CDMA phone. But as a CDMA right. phone, it's very reliable, at least you know, any place that I want to go. And a secret about Sprint that a lot of people don't know is that they roam on Verizon's network when they're out of their own coverage area. So just this weekend, I was up in New Hampshire, where, you know, up in the valleys, the mountains, where there isn't great Sprint coverage, but I could get a couple bars of Verizon most of the time. It's a slower data service on Verizon when you're roaming, but, you know, I could still use my phone with Sprint, and I'm a big fan of being able to use my phone, so.
Right. The Evo is a gorgeous phone. We have a couple at work where I work too, and they, man, you can't beat that screen.
Yeah, I mean, the hardware is not quite the same as that iPhone 4. It's not made anywhere close to a Leica camera per se, but right. I like the touch buttons. I like, you know, the fact that it's a big screen. It's easier for me to see. And it offers you some unique capabilities, like having the 8-megapixel camera or Wi-Fi sharing, where you can share your network with 8 computers over Wi-Fi. I just think that's, you know, once again, that's choice, and I'm excited about having that with me wherever I go.
Have you guys heard of the Dell Streak? No?
I haven't seen one.
Is that the one that's running Android 1.6? They just announced one of these tablets that's going to ship with the older version of Android. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we've had them in here for, I mean, months now. I mean, how you could use it as a phone is beyond me. And it's not big enough to be used as a tablet either, in the sense of the iPad. So I don't really think that. It seems like Dell's tried to go kind of in the middle, hoping it'll get both. They've kind of ended up hitting neither.
My secret hope, though, is that with these larger screen devices like the Dell Streak or the Evo, that someone's going to port the you know, that wonderful Einstein-Newton project to one of these Android phones. You know, they're not limited by Apple's limitation about running emulators. All we have to do is get that Einstein project ported to Android, and then we've got a Newton emulator with us. We're future-proof in terms of hardware. We're ready to go. we can bring that Newton experience with us wherever we want.
I've said before that an Android tablet is actually very attractive. I think they would be pretty neat to use just because of, you know, the way the file system works. And
well, one half of me loves the iPhone, loves the minimalisticness, loves the design. It's beautiful. You know, you switch to one app at a time. But then with Android, you open up the possibilities of having the file system and being able to really port in, you know, files and information from one application to the other. That's just, that, you know, completes the computing experience for me. You can't have a full computer in which you are locked out of using your data. And right. The iPhone, in all its grace and design, locks you out of using your data in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and we're computer geeks, so you know, that feeling is probably a little bit stronger just because we enjoy using computers and, you know, we work with them all the time, that kind of thing. Mm.
That's very true. But, you know, like a phone is a cloud device. And why can't I get my music onto my iPhone? Why do I have to sync it to get the media onto it? With Android, I can just download a movie from the internet or sync my music, pull it off a Dropbox, and then it's on my device. I can make playlists out of it. I can listen to it. It's with me wherever I go. On my phone, if I want to move or even, God forbid, delete music from my device, it all happens through iTunes. And, you know, that was wonderful. You know, it held people's hands for the last couple years, but I think a lot of people have moved beyond that, and I'm ready for Apple to release a cloud-based, you know, service that allows us to manage our iTunes media.
Right. Yeah. Well, the rumors say it'll be coming soon. I don't know. They don't seem to have this cloud stuff figured out quite yet.
Yeah, that or that Law service or something like that. You know, they're going to come out with that.
Yeah.
And we'll see how they do. But if it's any, you know, if iWork.com or even MobileMe is any inclination to how that's going to be, I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah. No, thank you.
I don't think anyone really does mobile really well. I mean, Google offers all these services. Yeah. Microsoft offers all these catch-up services. But with the exception of Dropbox, I haven't seen a lot of things that are, like, fantastic mobile services.
I think what's neat is an Apple-esque packaging on Google's services. That's what it needs.
Exactly.
It needs
and some more features that matter to individual users and not just to engineers.
Yeah.
Right. Now you were a Palm guy, didn't you try out the Palm?
Yeah. So one of the benefits of my job is that I get to try out a lot of phones on Sprint because we, as a business customer, each new line doesn't have a contract. We can order new phones. And sometimes they send me new phones. So they sent me a Palm Pre back in the day and then a Palm Pixie, and I tried those phones out. And I'm a big fan of the WebOS stuff. You know, it had just enough multitasking that you could switch between apps easily and get to see some of the files that you wanted to see. You know, it was kind of the in-between the iPhone and Android, best of both worlds. But the problem is that it's only on Palm, and their hardware is, you know, outdated now. So,
right.
It's, you know, when they got bought out by HP, I just couldn't see myself sticking with the platform.
But you got to try it, get a broad view.
I'm spoiled rotten. I got to try it. It was fantastic for the time I was using it. Best part, that Touchstone charger. You know, it sounds like a stupid, overpriced device, but being able to just slap your phone right there and have it charge and then pick it up instantly or answer it on the charger and it immediately becomes a speakerphone, that's very Apple-esque. You know, the best I can get with Android is the fact that you can plug in a mini USB and charge it. I like having that, you know, uniform charger amongst all of my devices. But that Touchstone was nice, and I wish more devices incorporated it.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to think about it.
Exactly. You know, it just sits on your desk at the end of the day and charges silently, ready to go when you are.
Right. You used to be an Apple Store guy, right? You worked in the Apple stores, and were you a genius? Was that was your job?
Well, that's true as well. I actually started out as a specialist. They had already hired the geniuses for the new store that they were planning on opening, and from there I just moved up the ladder and became a genius and then became a lead genius for a while. And as part of that, you know, they fly you out to Cupertino and train you and you have to pass some tests and then you come back and you work that genius bar queue line. At least when I worked, they didn't have a queue, you know, people just got in line and kind of like bit each other's heads off to get remain in place. But yeah, that was it was interesting. You know, I did that. I worked at Apple. I've been there, done that. I don't know if I would do it again, but it's got some neat stories. It's not the same, you know, working at retail as working at Apple corporate, but right. You know, you have a badge, you can go to Apple corporate. It was neat, you know, apple.com email address.
Why wouldn't you do it again? Why do you say that?
Well, I might do it again outside of retail or outside of a retail store. There was, you know, the talk of me doing some longer term services and support with AppleCare, maybe AppleCare in the enterprise. But unfortunately, in my situation, I couldn't, you know, meet the transportation needs of that occupation. So it looked like I was stuck in retail, and that's why I left. But Apple's a fantastic company to work for. But the problem is that I swear customers with all their rumors, you know, us, the technorati fanatic people that follow Apple, we know more about what's happening in Apple than the people that work inside of Apple. They all work under their own group shrouds. They all have their individual, passcodes for different projects they're on. You know, you could be at Cafe Max and you could be like, hey, what are you working on? And, you know, oh yeah, I'm working on Nexus. And you'd be like, what are you working on? I'm working on, you know, Jupiter. You know, you can't talk about it. And it sounds like, you know, you have all these ideas about living the Mac, you know, life. And, you know, especially us who have all this adoring, you know, affirmation for Apple history. That doesn't exist at Apple. It's a lot of, you know, secret projects and things happening in the background. And look, there it gets announced by Steve. And it's amazing. It's awesome. But it's, you know... I don't know. It's not like you're in on something huge when you're working there. You're in on the secret that your group's working on, and that's about it.
Right.
But I'm sure other people have different experiences. Mine was mostly retail based, and retail people sell computers. So, yeah.
You don't have a secret pipeline of information directly from Cupertino.
No. I have a hard time believing most people do because. To do so outside of those, Chinese manufacturers, you know, you basically could lose your job at any moment if you're sending out secrets. So right. I think most people who work at Apple for the time that they're working at Apple like their jobs. They like working there. They, you know, and they don't want to lose them. I don't blame them. So
yeah, it makes sense.
A lot of secrets don't go out. You know, everything's locked. I can tell you some stories, you know, when I was working there, the G5 was just under wraps and it came out. And, you know, it's true what they say. The blinds are closed. The doors are locked. There's like skulls and crossbones printed. Do not enter. Because, you know, there are new products being tested or documented behind those doors and curtains. And you can't go in. You can't go and see. There's... You know, waste paper baskets to destroy all evidence in each and every room. This is it's a very secretive company, and I think that's led to a lot of its success. But it also leads to, you know, segregated culture, at least from my standpoint.
Right. What was your least being a Mac genius, though?
I would love to go on a vacation and be a Mac genius for a week again and just repair people's computers. Because you sit at this desk and people come and you're like, how can I help you? I'm here to help you. And you're right. Usually able to let them leave happy. And it was a fun experience doing that. I wish I could do that again, at least for a short period of time. But working that day in and day out can get a little tiresome.
Right. What was the worst Mac you had to work on? What was the pain in the butt computer?
Oh, well, you know... So I was the lead Mac genius for a while there, and that's because they opened a new store and all the present Mac geniuses left. and I was forced to train a new batch of them. So as that, I used to do a lot more repairs, because when you come back from Apple training, you're capable of working the bar per se, maybe, but you don't have the wisdom gained from doing a lot of repairs. And so they would make me do the Macs at the time that had the most problems, or at least the most problems that we had to directly address. And those were things like G5s, because they're large and they have multiple processors that sometimes get unseated, and there's complications involved with that. For instance, the logic boards of a G5 have to match its processor type, so you have to look at the serial number and make sure the logic board matches the processor that you already have in there and that you order the correct processor for the logic board. It gets a little crazy. Another big one was Emacs. In the day and age of LCD computers, no one likes working on the big CRT Emacs. And a lot of the repairs for those involved taking them all apart and having to, degauss them. And, they sound dangerous almost. But, yeah, I had to work on a lot of Emacs and Power Mac G5s later in my career at Apple. They left the hard ones for me, I guess.
You got to see the best
of the
best.
My favorite Mac to work on, I'll tell you my favorite, and you included this in your new poetry site, Dave, was the all-in-one flat panel iMac G4. That thing is amazing to work on because it's all Apple. No other company would come out with a computer just like that, that half, what do people call it, half beach ball, half volleyball design and the metal neck. And that's just amazing. And there's so many special design intricacies that went into that. Two that are kind of commonly known, but these are the Steve Jobs-isms of that design, was if you look down into it, you can see that the hard drive is covered with a white piece of tape. It's like a big white sticker. And that covers the hard drive manufacturer's name and label. And that he wanted that covered so that you couldn't tell it was a Seagate or a Western Digital hard drive in there. You wouldn't be able to see that. You'd just be able to see white. So when replacing the hard drive, we would have to take off the sticker and put it back on. Or another thing is coming down from the neck, there's the microphone cable and the video cable and the airport cable and all these different little cables that come down the neck of the computer. And what you used to have to do is they'd be separated out with these little white plastic straws that are like spokes. So if you look down into this thing, you see the holes and there's a fan and there's these white spokes. And there's like five spokes, as I remember. But one of those five spokes is actually hollow. It's a piece of plastic. It's like a straw. And it's just put there to make everything look even. And that supposedly is another little design decision that, that spoke wouldn't be there in any other company's computer. In fact, if it was any other company's computer, you'd probably see the bare wires. But these wires were covered in plastic straws, and there were five of them, with one of them being empty. Things like that.
That's neat. Yeah, it's almost like they were showing off with the G4. It's like, what can we do that's just going to wow people if they actually take this thing apart?
Exactly. Although a big part of it was, so they had just come out with the Cube, and it was kind of like a big financial flop because it was overpriced, and a lot of the components didn't like being mounted vertically. The hard drive didn't like being mounted vertically. The optical drive certainly didn't like being mounted vertically. So the G4 was an interesting compromise design in that it took the components, like the hard drive and optical drive, that didn't like to be mounted vertically, and placed them horizontally in a weighted base. And then took the flat panel that everyone was anticipating in the new iMac and gave it, freedom by being able to move it wherever you wanted on that neck. It's an amazing design compromise and speaks to itself for its own brilliance. I just think that's fantastic, is knowing that the compromise is behind the design.
Right. Now, the iMac G5, how easy was that to work on when they went to the all flat panel stuff?
Well, the original iMac G5 was so easy to work on. Apple, I don't think a lot of people remember this, but Apple used to tout it as, this is the do-it-yourself repair iMac, and that you could open up the back and it had these bronze Phillips head screws, and you could remove a lot of those screws to remove the components that you would need to replace most often. So the optical drive came out as a separate component, and the hard drive was a separate component, and things, you know, they just came out. In fact, it was possible to take out the whole screen, well, not the screen, but the whole logic board, everything on top of the display. So if you're lying the screen down on a desk, everything like the logic board and, you know, the fans, the processor, of course, everything on that came off. And that was something called the midplane. And that would be pulled out and replaced if a customer was suffering from a logic board issue or a processor issue or some kind of squeaky fan. You'd actually replace this huge thing, or Apple would send you this in the mail and you'd replace this huge thing yourself and send it back to them.
Huh.
And that was a good idea, except that during that time, a lot of electronics companies were suffering from these bad capacitors out of China. And these capacitors were an inherent problem in the iMac G5s, the first batch of them. So if you ever open up an iMac G5 that isn't working, you see these bulging capacitors. That's the problem. And we, as an Apple store, we had to replace a lot of these computers. And by replacing, you know, these computers, it became apparent that, you know, replacing a whole huge component and sending it back to Apple was not the most efficient way to do it. So they would start sending us the logic boards directly, and we'd have to, you know, instead of taking five steps to take out this big mid-plane with the logic board and the fan and the processor and the, this and that and the speakers and everything, you would have to detach all of these different components and then pull out the logic board itself and send it back. So it gave us more work to do as Mac geniuses. And because of that amount of work, a lot of times, you know, Apple just had people go into the Apple stores and not do it, the do-it-yourself repair yourself.
Right. Were those the G5s that they just went they would just turn off?
Yeah, well, they suffered from two problems, and it was both capacitor-related in that, one, the power supply on those machines could be faulty because of capacitors, so yes, that would just turn off. Or it'd smell like burning or something like that. And the other one was it could get distorted video from the logic board capacitors. So it was one of those two things. A lot of times it was both, and those components would have to be replaced.
Hmm.
Yeah. Right.
And now, you know, an iMac is, you almost don't want to touch it.
Exactly. So later iMacs, starting with the iSight G5 and then the, you know, the white Intel one, and now we have these aluminum and black ones, they don't open nearly the same way, you know. The iMac G5 one opens in the back. You have to stick a credit card in the back air vent, and you take off the front of the display, and it actually kind of like clicks open, and then you have to take off all this tape to get around the display, and then that comes off, and it seems like it never goes back the same way. Of course, you know, a trained professional can do some of this, but right. The other ones, the modern ones, the ones with glass, they actually come off by putting a suction cup. If you're an Apple repair technician, you can buy a suction cup from Apple. It's the kind of things that they install glass windows with, and you pull off the glass and then get into the computer that way.
That's probably a little bit more nerve-wracking than just opening up the back.
You know, things like RAM, they do make easy to put in. And I think, can you easily put another hard drive, replace the hard drive in the new iMacs, or am I making that up?
Well, in the very new ones, you can actually have an SSD. You can have like a 2.5-inch hard drive and a regular hard drive in the 27-inch models. And that's just because the 27-inch models are just, you know, humongous. They're begging for more things to go in there. But that's kind of a build-to-order option unless you're really daring. You know, I have this iMac in front of me right now. It's the previous 21-inch model iMac. God forbid, I don't want to touch it, you know, because I know what's inside it. I don't want to open it up. If I had to, that would be one thing, but I'm not going to open it up to do anything internally with it, you know.
Right.
And that's kind of how they are. They're great computers for what they are.
It's kind of a shame, though, that, you know, they're harder to upgrade, and if something goes wrong, you almost have to replace the whole darn thing.
Yeah, you know, I've got a lot of doctors at the hospital, and they want to get IMAX for their home. But the problem is if something goes terribly wrong with it, even software-wise, if the OS needs to be reinstalled, they can't do that for themselves. So they have to, you know, drag the iMac back in, and you'll see them bring it in wrapped in towels or in a suitcase, or, you know, some people keep the box. But, it, you know, they bring in this iMac, and I have to restore it for them, and then they bring it home again. But if they had something like a Mac Pro or a Mac Mini, well, with the Mac Pro, you just take out the hard drive, you bring it in. I have a Mac Pro at work. I can stick it in my Mac Pro and rebuild it for them. Or if they have a Mac Mini, well, you bring the whole computer in, and I can fix that for them. But, yeah, the iMacs are, you know, a love-hate relationship when it comes to servicing them.
Yeah. You have to get your own gurney.
As an experienced Apple person, though, I can tell you that they're not the worst computers to service, but they, you know, they do get a little tricky, and they're definitely
in particular the iBooks.
Not
I
for
remember
the average
back
consumer.
When I was considering an iBook. Now I've got this PowerBook. I was looking into replacing the hard drive because they didn't exactly ship with huge hard drives by today's standard. So I looked at how to replace the hard drive, and oh dear, you have to take the whole thing apart basically, like.
Yep.
Split it into the same components they put together in the factory, just to swap the hard drive out.
Oh, those iBooks, you know, we were talking about this before the show, but there were a group of iBook G3s that had ATI video issues, and so, you know, we'd have to send those out to get the logic boards replaced, and a problem with that is that a lot of people would be like, well, I need my data. And if the computer's completely fried, you can't get your data off of there by doing FireWire target disk mode or whatever. It just won't work. So you'd have to open up the whole iBook and get the hard drive out of that. And you became pretty good at that. But it's like 60-something screws, and it's plastic snaps. And some of those things, if you don't know what you're doing, it will never go back the same way again. So, yeah, you know, or the 12-inch PowerBook. Not the same plastic snaps, but you have to take the logic board out to get to the hard drive. It's in there good. The iBook G3 clamshell is probably the worst. That one, you have to take off the display to get to the hard drive, which is underneath like a little metal clasp thing that's underneath the display. You know, it's just a mess. And now you see that Apple does it right, because now the computers, you just take off the back, or you have a little slot where the battery comes out, and boom, there's the hard drive for you to pull out. But on some of those older portables, it was a real nightmare.
I know the most I've ever done with my iBook G3 clamshell was put an airport card in there, and that was hard enough. You know, I can't imagine putting a new hard drive in there.
Yeah, that, you know... That was supposed to be easy too, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
that was not a
I don't think
super
they even sold
iBook
G3s with it pre-installed, did they? Or maybe they did.
You could buy one to order, and I think maybe the graphite or lime ones back in the day,
yeah.
You know, the higher end models, they might have
The stock iBook G3 that was supposed to change the world with revolutionary.
With wireless, yeah.
Pain in the ass to put the damn card in.
Yeah, mine's a Blueberry model, one of the first, like, 333 megahertz or something like that. And
They were like 233 megahertz and 333 megahertz. Mm. They were early with 66 megahertz system buses.
Tom, I have to ask you this. Did you ever get any people bringing, like, PowerBook 5400s in, or, you know, like Macintosh SE30s to get them serviced?
Yeah, well, we had a service at the Apple store. They had a service where you could do, I think they still offer it now if you ask them, but we were big in the day, it was, you know, transferring the data from your older computer. So Apple won't service a computer once it's over 7 years old. I guess there's this law in California where you have to, you know, maintain a warranty status in parts for 7 years. But after 7 years, something becomes vintage, and they can no longer get parts for it. I think it's actually before that it becomes vintage. Vintage is maybe 7 years; it's obsolete. But there becomes a point where it can't get parts.
Pineapple technician, then.
Yeah.
I think it's a 2004.
Well, you know, and there's a lot of Apple technicians that aren't, you know, you're not trained on that. As a Mac genius that started when OS 9 was being phased out, I was barely trained in OS 9. I knew a great deal about it from my own experiences, but, you know, if you go into a store and talk to a Mac genius today about OS 9, I doubt they'll have any idea what that is. But, yes, we used to see old computers, and I had a 1400, a PowerBook 1400 of my own that I left in my locker at the Apple store because one of the unique things about this 1400 was that it had a local talk connection and an Ethernet connection. And this was a great help because you could plug it into something old like a Performa and transfer, you know, the person's resume or writing or whatever they thought was important to them at the time, and transfer it onto the 1400 that had Ethernet, and then transfer that onto a Mac running Mac OS X. And that was like a great bridge computer for the absolutely, you know, oldest of the old. We had people coming in with Duos and stuff that didn't have any kind of other connection other than a local talk connection and a modem port. And we were able to do it with the 1400. Not a service Apple offers today, I can tell you, but, you know, anything to help the customer. Well, the migration assistant came out when I was working as a Mac genius. It came out in 10.3.5, which was a kind of like sub-update. So, you know, you bought 10.3, didn't have the migration assistant, but then later on they started making disks with 10.3.5 and you started to see it included on computers. And the migration assistant has changed everything, at least for computers with FireWire, because you can just connect two computers and it does the task of moving things. You know, like back in the day, we'd have to move from documents to documents, library to library, music to music. And now the migration assistant not only takes care of that, but takes care of most of the applications they have installed as well. You know, it's amazing. It makes my job 100 times easier. Even though I know how to migrate things myself, why go through the hassle when you can just plug in a FireWire cable and have the migration assistant take care of it? But we didn't have that back, you know, in 10.2, you didn't have a migration assistant, so you had to copy everything yourself.
What got you into Macs, Tom? What was your first one, and what got you started on them?
Well, I grew up with a Mac 512K, but it was my dad's, and I was a little kid, because I'm only 26, so, you know, I didn't know much about it. And to tell you the truth, I wasn't actually into computers any more than any other red-blooded boy growing up in America was into computers. You know, I liked it to play games, but we had a Mac, we had a PC. I didn't know the difference, really. I just played with what I had. And in high school, I kind of went through one of those crazy alternative phases, and I was into art and, you know, drawing, and I did a lot of pen and ink drawings, and I just happened to take a desktop publishing class to fill a credit. And what blew me away was that in our school, all of the PCs were locked down. You know, you couldn't even empty the trash without asking for someone's permission. You couldn't use the CD-ROM without asking someone's permission. But in my renegade youth, the Macs were free and open. You know, they were old Macs. They were like Power Mac 8500s and 7200s. But they were free and they had Internet Explorer on them, and it was amazing because you could do whatever you wanted. And then I figured out that you could file share with them because they had this thing called Local Talk, and you could connect the phone lines in all the classrooms of my high school. And before you know it, we had Napster running on these old Macs, and we were sharing music and playing games on this network that no one else could, you know, knew about because they thought their Windows PCs running NT were completely secure, and we were using these old Macs. So, you know, the whole idea of sharing files, of printing to a printer that's connected to one Mac, it's amazing. You know, they touted when the MacBook Air came out that you could stick a CD in one Mac and be able to access its contents wherever you were. Well, I had a Mac PowerBook 5300 that I scrounged up in high school, and I used to be able to stick the CD in another Mac and then plug it in with Local Talk and see the contents of the CD on the 5300, you know, that stuff is amazing to me, having that kind of file share and having everything easy. You guys know because you stick with the old Macs more than probably I do. But remember back in the days where everything in the Mac OS had its own icon, like every system extension, every preference, had its own like individual icon. I think those were neat, and it was very a visual operating system. And so that combined with the fact that no one else was using it got me into Macs. And Nowadays, I just have to laugh because people join Facebook and Twitter and they say, look, I just got my first Mac. And, they were laughing at me back in high school when I bought my first one, but I showed them or something like that.
I'll be darned. So an illegal hobby and a little bit of rebellious attitude. That's what you need to be a Mac guy.
I guess so. Something at the time of that clicked. To tell you the truth, I wasn't so big into the fact that you could share music. I don't have any of that music today. But I guess I wasn't so much into the music per se, because the quality wasn't that good, whatever, as the fact that you could actually do it and share things. And, I could be in my math classroom and connect to the Macs down in the desktop publishing lab because they were connected by Apple Talk or whatnot. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And because Apple makes it so easy to connect them that...
Exactly. You couldn't do that with the PCs. One, because of the restriction, but... Two, PCs before XP, unless you knew the exact address to type in, good luck finding anything on the network, unless you had a system administrator establishing everything for you. It was hard, but AppleTalk and Bonjour and all these wonderful technologies that just auto-discover themselves, it's like, look, on the network, there's my Mac down in the classroom with my files on it, and I can get to it wherever I want. I guess the same carries true to Dropbox today. I'm just fascinated by having my stuff with me wherever I want to be.
Right. And you don't have to know the IP address.
And usually you don't even have to know the name other than that it looks familiar. It's just that good.
Right. How fun. So you've got an iMac now, and you've got the iPad. What did you have before the iMac?
Well, just like phones, I'm spoiled with this job that I sometimes get to try out a lot of computers. So for a long time, I had the 12-inch PowerBook. I mean, I guess I'm not going to go back so far, but in the last 5 years, I've had the 12-inch PowerBook that I bought secondhand because it was brand new and I just wanted to have one. I heard like Merlin Mann or someone talking about 12-inch PowerBooks, and I was like, oh, I remember having one of those back in the day. I want to have one, so I bought one. And I had a Mac Mini, an Intel Mac Mini, because I could get work to pay for it, and then I figured I could bring it home. So instead of getting an iMac, I got a Mac Mini because then I could bring it home with me every day, and I'd use it at home, and then I'd pack it up and bring it back to work. So that was, they wouldn't pay for me to have a laptop at that time, but they would pay for me to have a Mac Mini. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Huh. And so it's like the original Macintosh idea where you could put it on your bicycle and just take it home.
Exactly, And I just saw on Twitter, Cable Sasser was posting about someone in a coffee shop using a flat panel monitor and a Mac Mini in a coffee shop. So, I wasn't quite that bad. I just brought it. What I did is I bought two Mac Mini power supplies and then had a keyboard and mouse and Bluetooth and set up at either location. So I just come with the Mac Mini and basically plug it into its power, and everything else was like wireless and it would just go, and that was cool.
That's great.
Believe it or not, I had an Apple TV that I used as a Mac for a while, in that I put Mac OS X on it just to be able to do it and boot it. And it, I had like the expectation of I want to be able to do word processing and like Twitter and Coda maybe and get those things to work. And it sort of worked and it was okay, but it wasn't meant to do that. The biggest limitation is that like the sound didn't work and the wireless networking was iffy. The wireless network worked, but the Ethernet was iffy. You had to get a special driver. And then, it only worked on certain widescreen television resolutions. So unless you had like a 20-inch monitor with a 1280 resolution or a 1080 display or something like that, which were rare at the time when the Apple TV came out, with the exception of HD televisions, it wouldn't display right. But you could do it if you wanted to, and I did that for a while.
That's crazy. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, well, they had this whole project when the Apple TV came out. They were like, look, you can put Mac OS X on it, and it's a Mac because it's made by Apple. But that was like, you know, saying Adele is a Mac because it was using the same kind of Hackintosh port, and the Apple TV is just like a 1 gigahertz Celeron processor or whatever it is. So it really wasn't any different than having Adele or whatever you want to say with Mac OS X on it. But I did that for a while. Hmm. And then I had a couple of MacBooks. I had a MacBook 15-inch, I had a MacBook Air, and I had a MacBook 13-inch, which I've all given to different people in the hospital now, and now I'm on the iMac.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the new Mac Mini, and I much prefer, you know, your model, because the new Mac Mini is it almost seems too big. It's too flat and wide or something like that.
I think it's the exact same size as the Apple TV.
Right.
Yeah, it's wider like the Apple TV is. It's a little taller. We have one or two of them in at work because they make good small workstations with dual monitor capabilities, even if you run Windows on it. But the biggest thing I like about the new Mac Mini over the old Mac Mini is it's got that integrated power supply. Because if you look at a Mac Mini, the old ones had a power supply that was like a quarter to a third the size of the Mac Mini. If you look at an old G4 Cube, the power supply was like half the size of the Cube. And the new Mac Mini, just like the Apple TV, has no power supply. I mean, no external one. It's integrated. And that's fantastic. Because then you don't have to lug this big thing with you. And, you know, it's got HDMI and it's got multiple monitors. I like that idea about it. I haven't ever serviced one, so I don't know how I like taking it apart. But I looked
Speaking of sizes and, you know, old new models of things, Stephen Mount on Twitter the other day pointed out that the 27-inch cinema display and the 27-inch iMac, the displays don't like line up if you put them next to each other. And it was the same with the 24-inch cinema display when they had the 24-inch iMac. Seems strange.
They don't line up?
No, the cinema display is slightly lower than the iMac. So if you want to have a dual display set, the cinema display, you're either going to have to put a book under it or something.
A lot of people do put books under them, so.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, Apple pays attention to so many details, but if there's one thing they don't pay attention to, it's how their new products look with their old products. They never look in the past, and so that's probably a big reason for why that is.
No, but the cinema display doesn't have the chin, the little part at the bottom that the iMac does.
Yeah, the aluminium bezel at the bottom is missing.
Right. So that's probably it.
Yeah.
But still,
it's weird that they couldn't make the arm on the cinema display slightly longer and kind of make it line up. Or, you know, inversely, make the arm on the iMac slightly shorter to make them line up.
Well, you know, Steve never looks at the past. When he started at Apple, one of the first things he got rid of was the Apple Museum and the Icon Garden they had outside Infinite Loop. And he never looks at the past, so looking at past designs, you know, he's always forward, future-looking.
Yeah.
Right.
And speaking of the Steve Jobs and getting rid of the Apple Museum in the past, what about this, the Mac Paint source code release, which was, you know, typical right after we did the last show, but...
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't get to talk about it.
Well, David, you probably know more about it than I do, but my understanding is that it's amazing code to look at, but kind of useless in today.
Do you not program?
Do I know?
Do you program, Thomas?
No. Oh, yeah. No, not so much.
Oh, right. Okay.
I do web design. You know, I do some basic JavaScript and stuff like that, but my head has always been kind of visual and never anything past, you know, the most simplistic Boolean equation, so no.
Who is it in the Newton world I was thinking of? Programmer. I'll think of it.
But, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. It's really It is really readable. I don't program Pascal, but it, even for a non-Pascal programmer, I can see what the code is doing. You know, and sort of understand how it's working.
I'd like to take a look at it. I haven't gotten to it yet. I mean, I look at things like higher-level programming languages like PHP and Ruby and CGI scripts, and I can kind of make them out, but I definitely couldn't appreciate it the same way you could.
Yeah. Be interesting to see how much hasn't changed, you know, since then. What's kind of held over or stayed the same, if anything?
Well, yeah.
You guys must be terribly aware of the Mini VMac project, that Macintosh emulation 68K.
Oh, yeah.
And that I have loved running, System 1.1 and Mac Paint on that.
Yeah.
And that's a fantastic way to play around with those programs. I don't keep very many applications on my Mac, but I keep that.
Huh.
Yeah. I actually had a recent excuse to use that in my piece on the Dvorak keyboard. I needed to take that screenshot of the undo, cut, copy, paste menu. I'll admit that I spent considerably more time than it took to take a screenshot of the undo, cut, copy, view menu.
That's a good idea.
Undo, cut, copy, paste menu. Because it's just such a fun... So fun, so quirky.
Yeah, see, I just turned on my Mac SE and I got System 6, so that's what I play with.
There you go. You know, that emulator and, of course, the Einstein emulator, which I use to make the website and, you know, double-check my Newton layouts and things like that. It's fantastic legacy tools. In my opinion, it's better than having a Mac in some cases because, the Mac, things wear out, like floppy drives and CRT monitors, but that kind of stuff can last with you forever. So
right. And at least you get the idea of what it was like to use one. I don't find Einstein particularly useful, but it's fun to play around with and get screenshots.
Yeah, no, Einstein, the neatest thing to do with it is probably, well, the thing that I do with it is make screenshots to use for the website. But if you have a Wacom tablet and you can play with the handwriting recognition or draw shapes and, you know, we're spoiled because we have Newtons, but for people that don't have a Newton, I really wish that, you know, we could distribute the ROM along with that Einstein emulator and say, look at this. This is what we're talking about when we talk about this, you know, fantastic piece of Apple hardware. This is what people, you know, this is why CNET says that it's so good, or, you know, why there's this whole mailing list of 200-something people that stick around with this device. It's because of these little things that it just did so well, and it did them first. And I wish we could share that with people. And that was an idea behind my website. But, of course, I can't mimic those kind of behaviors that made the Newton the Newton.
Right. And just how fun it is to use. It's fun. It's a fun little gadget.
Yeah. And I think it's especially great when you can get it running on a touchscreen device. Like, people run it on their phones.
Right.
Like, maybe it's running on some smartphones, I don't know. But if it can run on smartphones, then that's good, because you do get the handwriting recognition kind of feel. And I know that Stephen Frank runs Einstein on his Modbook tablet Mac.
Yep.
All right. Well, it's been how many weeks since our last show? And how many weeks did it take for you to get episode 11 up? I forget.
too many.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just making sure I remembered it right.
I think it was only about 1 or 2 weeks, actually.
All right, I'm picking
like 3.
Right. But a bit's happened in the Apple world since we last met, right?
Has it?
Well, there's been new Macs, but there's always new Macs, and there's always new releases.
Yeah.
I think you covered the most applicable thing to your audience is that the Mac Paint was released, and things are just kind of the same as they've always been with the with the Mac community, at least the legacy Mac community. And I'm happy for that.
Yeah.
we're kind of holding on to each other these days because, you know, for us guys that like the Mac, we, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot of news to keep us going lately. It's been all iPhone and iPad and all that kind of stuff.
No, I understand that. And, you know, for a guy whose website resembles a Newton, I tend to stay away from the Newton Talk mailing list because there just seems to be all this fanatic talk. Like, if I use this PC slowdown and virtual PC and Windows 98 and my Newton and do this, I can sync my contacts. And I'm like, oh, God, really?
right.
I guess I'm just not that true-blooded a fan of these older things. But to me, the part that really stands out and the part that keeps these mailing lists and people alive and celebrating this stuff is the essence of what these technologies could do back in the day and what they do now. You know, what a fantastic technology floppy disks were when the first Mac came out, or handwriting recognition for the Newton. And I applaud those kind of reminders of a simpler era, because now, for a lot of people, the solution seems to be, well, you know, things are cheap. We can just throw more and more computers at it. And I just don't think that's the solution.
Right. Well, and some of the ideas that were pioneered with, like, the Newton, you know, that we take for granted these days, you know, that you can plug a device that has all your contacts and your calendar in and it syncs with your Mac, you know, that was quite the to-do back in the day, and now, it, you know, we kind of take it for granted.
Yeah, that was, that and the whole on the Newton, the whole document object model where documents come first, I you know, that was a big thing with Apple and their future OS, you know, Copland. And Project Pink and things like that. That was a big thing. And I don't think we'll ever see that again, you know. Will we ever see a point where documents come first? Maybe within the confines of Google Docs. But the iPhone, iOS, it's clearly about the apps. Android is becoming more and more about the apps. And, I kind of miss the days where things were about the documents. I'm excited that things now are more about the services and the clouds and things like that. But I miss when things were about the documents. Even HTML these days, it's becoming less and less about semantic documenting and more about, like, whiz-bang gadgetry and whatnot.
Right. Yeah, about it's even about web apps and things like that, you know, doing stuff through websites and that kind of thing.
Yeah, same thing, you know, but it's they're web apps. They're less about moving a document between different phases and more about, you know, producing things in apps. I don't
know. Right. Yeah, good old OpenDoc.
The problem with OpenDoc was that it didn't fit in with the Mac interface, and that it was document-oriented, and the Mac is really application-based.
That, and it was just, you know, I'm not an expert in that kind of stuff. I didn't work for Apple back in those days, but... a lot of that stuff was misguided newness, you know, you're jumping to this, you're jumping to that, you don't know, you're like chicken with your head cut off. And it takes a lot of work, as Steve Jobs has shown, to get everyone to adopt a new platform. And I don't think that kind of, you know, Apple wasn't targeted in one specific direction, and a lot of those technologies just didn't take off because of that. It was interesting seeing Steve come back and say, we're not doing this. We're not doing printers anymore. We're not doing cameras. We're not going in these directions. We're going here, and I'm going to take you there. And I think that's the big message of his legacy, is going in a direction and, you know, heading for it. And I'm excited. I'm excited to see Mac OS X grow up in my lifetime, from Rhapsody Server all the way to 10.6, where we are now, and I'm excited to see the future of the Mac OS. The people say, oh, iOS is going to be the future, and that might be a consumer product for a lot of people, but I want to see, you know, where we're going with more than just touch and 5-minute applications. I want to see where we're going with the productivity and the, you know, what iOS has to offer the Mac. more than what, you know, iOS is going to stand alone.
Amen.
Mm.
Amen, brother.
Yeah.
All right. Well, David, it was pleasure to talk with both of you guys. I know I've known you both for a while on Twitter and the mailing list, but it was good to actually hear your voices, especially David across the pond there.
Did you see that thing on Minimal Mac the other day about the Apple Extended Keyboard 2? I know you saw it, Dave.
Oh, yeah, and I... Well, you know I saw it because I told you I'd send you my keyboard.
Yeah, I can't handle the American layout, unfortunately. I've tried
the US.
Yeah.
I'm not as bad as Gruber.
It's actually not that different. The only difference in the Mac version is that in the American keyboard you press Option 3 to get the pound sign and Shift 3 to get the hash or octothorpe sign. And the return key is in the European shape on the British keyboard, and it's kind of the long return bar on the American. But even those two differences, you know, I'm just so practiced on where the return key is and pressing Option 3 to get to the hash, I just couldn't do it.
You're probably a far better typist than I am. That keyboard, though, that thing is a battleship. It's huge. I think it had the name of the Nimitz or the Saratoga as its code name, and it's huge. Right. And I don't know how Gruber does it. I guess if he's sitting in one place all the time typing, it's fantastic. But I was so thrilled when Apple came out with the little wireless aluminum keyboards because they're so small and, you know, minimalistic and whatnot. That Apple Extended keyboard, I've never used it. It looks brand new and it's sitting on my desk, but I need to get an iMate or some adapter to use it, and I've just never gotten around to it.
I'm using mine now. It's fantastic.
Clickety clickety. Give us some typing now. But don't quit the podcast.
Don't quit the podcast. Okay. Hold on a minute.
Mine's sitting next to my Mac SE right now because I've been doing some writing on the Mac SE, and it's just as big as the computer.
Here's a quick soundbite.
We're hearing the keyboard typing, and it sounds good. It sounds like you know what you're doing there.
Mm.
Yeah, we believe you. All right, David, well, what do you say we wrap this thing up?
Yeah, it's been a good episode. Thank you for being with us, Tom.
Yep.
My pleasure, anytime.
And Thomas, how do you think people should find out more about you the best? What's the best way?
Well, the two places are probably eggfreckles.net and twitter.com/ThomasBrand. So,
yep.
Search for me there. Him.
And David, where can people find you?
You can find me at dpk.org.uk.
With his new blog design, which, is not a new thing. Every time we have a new episode, he has a new blog design.
It's not that often.
You know, that's not so unfamiliar.
Right. And me, Dave Lawrence, you can find me at newtonpoetry.com. That's where I write about all this stuff. Although I've kind of been slacking lately and I need to get on it, so
a much more consistent site than the rest, might I say.
You've been saying you'll get on, you'll it's a problem with having beer while you're podcasting. You've been saying you'll get on I give up. No.
Well, hopefully he doesn't. Hopefully there'll be some more posts in the future.
Right, one more go. You've been saying you'll get on the case of posting since I think we started the show back in January. So that's 8 months of wanting to get back to Newton Poetry. So.
You know, David, I'm not a quitter, so I'm going to keep trying.
You know, at least I would be happy with his kind of post schedule. If I had that kind of schedule, I'd be happy.
Two times a week. If I don't do two times a week, then I kick myself. But
that's what I'm shooting for, two times. You and me. It'll be like some kind of like, you know, anonymous group meeting. Well, my name is Thomas Brand, and I have a posting problem, and
okay, well, we'll wrap this show up then. You've been listening to the Hello Show, episode number 12.
With me, David Kendall.
And me, Dave Lawrence, and our good friend...
Thomas Brand.
You can find us at helloshow.net, on Flickr, in our Flickr group, which I need to link up at some time. And also, email us. No, don't email us, because the address isn't working at the moment, and I'll fix it soon. But email us at podcast@helloshow.net and donate it via PayPal at the same address. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Right. Till next time.